Festival of Light, Talk 1 of 4, by Asha Praver, February 3, 2012, originally broadcast at Online with Ananda, your source for Ananda classes at www.anandaonlineclasses.org. Copyright 2012, Ananda Church of Self-Realization.
Hello, everyone. I'm Nayaswami Asha, and this is my first webinar of 2012, and I'm very, very happy to be here. Took a little holiday for the month of January, so it's nice to be back sharing with all of you. The subject of our webinar tonight and for the next 3 weeks, we're doing a four-part series. And that four-part series is on the Festival of Light. I believe everyone who watches these webinars is in some way connected with Ananda, since they're offered through Ananda Online Community and Ananda Online Classes. So I don't have to completely start from zero in telling you what the Festival of Light is, but I'll give you some idea here. It's the ritual that is part of the Ananda Sunday service. And it's been part of our Ananda Sunday service for maybe some 25 years. I've reached the age where I remember clearly things that happened 25 years ago. I know some of you listening to this were either children or not yet born 25 years ago. So it's a whole different way of thinking about things. But it's only been part of Ananda for the last 25 years. And therefore, the origins of it and the reasons why we do it are all part of my actual adult experience. So whereas many of you have never really known Ananda or our Ananda Sunday worship service without having, as the last 25 minutes or so of that service, what we call the Festival of Light, in fact, it was a conscious decision made by Swami Kriyananda to include that ritual in what we do. And I think it helps to keep all of us fresher and more conscious about what we do, to actually take the time to really understand why we do things rather than just sort of have them become the tradition or something like that. I'm not really fond of casting aspersions at all times on others, but as you may well also know, Ananda is the other. There are basically two primary organizations dedicated to the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda, their Self-Realization Fellowship, which Yogananda himself founded in 1925, and Ananda, which Swami Kriyananda founded in 1968. Swami Kriyananda, of course, is a direct disciple, and he founded Ananda as an expression of his master's teaching, of master's teachings, as we call him, Yogananda. And Yogananda himself, as I said, founded SRF. But there is a great difference of opinion as to whether Ananda or SRF is more loyal, more representative, is how I would put it, of the master's intentions. And the primary difference between SRF and Ananda, which is not, it's not a question of sincerity, and it's not a question of whether or not people in both organizations are nice, because people in both organizations are nice. I often joke that if you're going to be trapped on a desert island or stuck in a lifeboat, you would really rather have SRF members than most people on the planet. We have more in common with SRF members than we do with most other people, because after all, they're dedicated to the same master and follow the same essential teachings. But there is one really fundamental difference, and it's a profound and serious theological difference, which I don't think can ever be reconciled. SRF believes that spiritual authority is primary in spiritual life, and that authority is passed through disciples because of their position in SRF. Swami Kriyananda believes, and has built Ananda on the premise, that anyone who attunes themselves to the master is equally able to be a channel for the master, not only has the capacity but the responsibility to do so, and that spiritual authority comes from attunement, and organizational position does not create it. Now, the reason I mention this in this context is, For many years, in the early years of Ananda, there was very little form to it. We did have Sunday services from the very beginning, but there was a great deal of informality about it. You could read from various of the writings related that Swami Kriyananda had written or that Master had written, but if you were responsible for leading a Sunday service, as I was even in those times from the early 80s, nonetheless, you kind of made it up a lot. And I think we might have had sermon topics, but I'm not even 100% certain whether we did or not. It's a little unclear to me now. But there was an enormous amount of latitude given to the person leading the service as to content. And there was no ritual. There was no repeating ritual beyond chanting and prayers. But those were always changeable. You prayed spontaneously, and the chants were selected by whoever wanted to select them. And as I was saying, the readings were also personally selected most of the time. And then you would give a sermon on either an assigned topic or, more likely, I think, just on whatever you felt like speaking about. That seems a little extreme to me, so maybe we did have a year of topics. But as Swami Kriyananda put it, there were two fundamental disadvantages to that. There were obvious advantages, which it was just very casual and very spontaneous and, very, very free. And if you were an individual who had a lot of enthusiasm for worship, which has always been something that I particularly enjoyed. There are different kinds of devotees, and I like liturgy. I like worship services. It's something I've always been very creatively interested in. It was a lot of fun. You just could sort of, every Sunday would come around, and you could think about lots of different aspects about how you wanted to put the service together. But as Swami Kriyananda pointed out, it made the service, to a very large extent, dependent on who was leading it. And, some people have more interest than others. Some people have more God-given abilities than others. And also what it did was, every single Sunday service, which has always been the unifying core of our communities and our work, so to speak, has been that coming together to worship on Sunday morning. Of course, it's a Western tradition, but the idea of satsang is also an Eastern tradition, where true seekers come together to attune themselves to a higher reality. It meant that every time that service was given, there would only be a certain very, very small slice of what Ananda was really all about offered to people. It could be keys to success, it could be how to be happy in your marriage, it could be secrets of radiant health, or it could be, some small aspect of meditation or some specific aspect of the guru. And if you were someone coming from the outside, meaning that you were not already steeped in these teachings, you would come to this Ananda Sunday worship and you would walk away with a certain impression about what Ananda stood for, and that impression, by definition, would be quite limited. Well, that was fine, as long as Ananda was primarily residential community, and for many years up until that time, Ananda was primarily residential community, singular. It was Ananda Village, and almost everyone who showed up at that Sunday service was already living at the community and totally steeped in it, and therefore the fact that it was such a narrow slice was not really significant. But what happened, starting in the 80s, and really, gaining momentum by the mid and the late 80s, is that Ananda began to expand into Europe and began to expand around the United States more. And really, within a matter of a few years, we went from being a single residential community into really being a global movement. In multiple countries and in multiple cities in the U.S., with varying degrees at that point in the mid-80s of, gravitas to the work that we had created, how deep the roots were, how substantial the development was, and so on. The urban communities that we have now were just beginning and not really fixed yet. But what Swamiji saw happening was something that he had always anticipated, because he's always had a picture of the vision of where Ananda was going, that even when the rest of us thought we were just going to live happily in that rural community, in this isolated, lovely little dream world. I don't mean dream in the sense of disconnected from reality, but dream in the sense of perfect, you know, a dream come true kind of world. Swamiji knew we had much more work to do. And so these issues, the fact that there was no consistent overall presentation of what this path was about, the fact that the Sunday service was so entirely dependent on the inspiration of the individual leading it, these things he knew were not going to provide for Ananda the vehicle for the spread of the vibrations of Master through Ananda that Swamiji knew Master wanted of us. But he was biding his time. He was waiting. When he was asked, you know, did you always know that something like the Festival of Light and actually the purification ceremony, which he created at the same time, did you always know these were coming? He said, oh yes, it just wasn't timely. It was just a matter of reaching a certain stage of maturity where we would both understand it and accept it, and also where it was required. Prior to that, it wasn't required. So I believe it was in 1986, and it must have been in the fall of 1986. By that point, Ananda was beginning to establish itself in Italy. And in fact, we had started in a villa. It was actually a summer villa in the vacation area of Como in northern Italy. I mentioned that it was a summer villa because Como is very cold in the winter, and Lake Como it is. And we actually started our community over the winter in the summer villa at Lake Como, which I wasn't part of that, but it was a lot of tapasya. The holy water on the altar was frozen solid in the mornings. That's how people described it. It was an uninsulated summer home that they went through what turned out to be one of the coldest winters in 100 years. It was quite an experience. Jyotish, who was part of that year, was born and raised in Austin, Minnesota. Not Austin, Texas, Austin, Minnesota. And he laughingly said he understood why he had grown up in Minnesota, so that he could go through the coldest winter in a century in Italy and say, well, that wasn't too bad. But it was pretty hard on everyone. But in 1986, they moved the community from Lake Como, which, as Swamiji said, is really a vacation area. People come there to vacation, not to be serious spiritually. They moved it to the spiritual heart of Italy, and in many ways one of the spiritual hearts of the whole planet, which is Assisi, Italy. And in that context is when the Festival of Light was written. And I was saying earlier in my reference to SRF, one of the reasons I feel like it's important to keep this story in front of people is because SRF defends a lot of policies and programs and decisions and traditions that they instigated years after Master died by claiming somehow that they have some special line to Master, and that they're only doing exactly and in absolute detail exactly what he said, and people are given the impression, or even sometimes the explicit statement, that 25 years after Master's death, you know, he left some time capsule of instruction that, you know, that some officer of SRF would get, and then now's the time to change this paragraph in the autobiography of a yogi. And I don't mean to be rude, but I don't like to be treated like that. I don't like to be told that the reason we do things is because we have special access to secret information that you will never have access to and that can't be comprehended by reason, so you just have to take our word for it. It's not my path. Swami Kriyananda has trained us in a completely different manner. And even when he talks about the most esoteric ideas, he always tries to bring them down to a level where we can actually apply both our own intelligence and our own experience to it, so that we can, one, learn how to think about spiritual matters and not just feel that it's just a question of obedience or blind faith, but also that we can actually learn to reason properly between true and false teaching, and that we can participate in the actual creative process of serving Master. And in fact, all of that is inherent in the Festival of Light, the necessity to take responsibility and to be an active channel oneself is part of what the Festival of Light constantly reaffirms for us every week or more when we listen to the words and go through that ritual. It gives us the foundation for how to be a devotee in the way that Swami Kriyananda has trained us. So anyway, going back to this, but even the Festival of Light itself, I want you to understand, came for reasons at a particular time to fulfill particular needs as a certain kind of inspiration. Yes, it was guided by Master, but it was guided by Master because of the attunement of a disciple, not because of a special opportunity to get written instructions that we'll just execute without thinking about ever thereafter. So, it was 1986, and Ananda was just settling into Assisi, and this was a very big deal, not merely for our work in Italy and not merely for our work in Europe, because Ananda is very much tied together, and going back to the origin point of the festival, reading some comments that Swamiji made about it at the time, Swamiji has always seen Ananda's work as being a dynamic, creative combination of the consciousness of America and, as it turns out, of Italy and of India. Italy, in many ways, represents the devotional heart of Europe. There's a great deal of difference between various countries, between England, Germany, and Italy. You can see all in a heartbeat that there's very different energies in those three countries, and they're all Europe. But Italy's the country that has produced the most saints, Italy and Spain especially. That's where the most saints come from. And Italy has also been the innovative heart in art and music and many, 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 many fields of creative human potential have been initiated from Italy. But especially in the spiritual realm, the essence of the Italian nature is devotional. And India, of course, has the depth of the ages behind it. But America is the country where Master chose to start this, because Americans also have a unique contribution to make to spiritual life, which is creative initiative, individuality, individual independence, and also this, what Master called the can-do spirit. Because America is a very young country, very young, and has no glory in the past, America's very free. We're very Dwapara. We're very of this era. We're also the land of equal opportunity. Every soul, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with the same inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's really quite a revolution. No caste, no class. You can come to America from any background and in a very short period of time, with the exercise of creative initiative, you can be equal to anyone. That's just simply not true in other places. But having said that, what I really wanted to say here is that Swamiji has always seen the essence of the spirit of Ananda as being a combination of these forces, the American spirit, the devotion represented by Italians and expressed by Italians, and the depth of ancient understanding and spiritual power that has always been India. And the world being what it is, with fast transportation and communication, individuals and energy just passes around the globe so readily and so quickly, that as soon as Ananda became focused in Italy, and then especially focused in Assisi, Italy, that vibration began to characterize Ananda globally. And Swami Kriyananda was very involved, has been very involved in the founding of our work in Europe and also our work in India now. And so he was spending time in Italy, and he was actually, he took a long seclusion in a house near where the community was situated at that time in Assisi, Italy. And it was during the time that he was in seclusion that he felt inspired by Master that it was time to bring this ritual forward. And the idea of how to write it, he said he wrote it in a matter of a couple of days. It just, the ideas just simply came to him. And even as we get into it a little further, in the middle of the festival, there's a story about, it begins, a fledgling bird flew out of its nest, away from its nest. And Swamiji himself jokingly says, when he was writing it and all of a sudden this fledgling bird appeared, he himself said, "What? What is this about a fledgling bird?" But then he said that whenever anything comes to him in the way that that thought came to him, he doesn't question it. He certainly doesn't repudiate it, because there's a, he didn't go farther, but I know what he was really saying was there's a superconscious flow. And when a creative idea comes to him through superconsciousness, he understands it as coming from Master and that Master's manifesting through him. And he doesn't want to interrupt that flow with mere quibbling intellectual objections, like, what is this about the bird? In the first years that we did the Festival of Light, there was a lot of joking about the fledgling bird. And in fact, the first version of the festival, that story was longer and more complicated. After a couple of years, Swamiji edited it down a little bit to what I'm sure all of you are accustomed to hearing now, because it was just a little bit too long. But even though sometimes people joke about it, and I'll in the course of 3 weeks, I have the luxury here of 4 weeks to go over this, a tremendous amount of the most important teaching in the festival is contained in the story of the fledgling bird, because the fledgling bird represents the evolution of the soul. And what this ritual is about, and I'll just mention this before I go back to the history of it, is really about soul evolution. And soul evolution is the spiritual path. And the right understanding of what soul evolution, I'm using the phrase soul evolution, which is, technically speaking, not really an accurate phrase, because the soul doesn't evolve, the soul is infinite. We use it in English, we speak of soul evolution, but what we really mean is self-realization, the gradual awakening to self-realization. We think of it as the soul evolving, but the soul is just the same. It's the jiva, the individual, gradually shifting its understanding from ego identity to soul consciousness. And that's what the bird represents, is the journey from ego consciousness to infinity. And the journey from ego consciousness to infinity is the whole story. And so having it personified by this little creature who, through its little adventures, goes through what the soul goes through, and living that journey week after week is part of what the power of ritual is about. Well, I'm skipping ahead, but I'll come back to that in a moment. So Swami Kriyananda was in Assisi, and he was in seclusion, and over the course of several days, the whole of the Festival of Light came to him, and he wrote it. And he wrote the songs, or he wrote lyrics for a melody that he had, and he drew in a couple of songs that he had written for the oratorio, and then he had the ritual, just as a matter of interest. As it happened, David and I, with Durga and Vidura, were in India during the month of October, probably there, and we were after India, and that was our first trip to India. It was a very potent fall. And more than that, David and I, since July of that same year, 86, Swamiji had asked us to move to Palo Alto, where we've lived ever since, to take responsibility for Ananda's urban center here, which was fledgling at that time. And he wanted us to take charge of it. And just about that same time, just a little before, he asked Ananta and Maria to move to Sacramento. The moving of us to Palo Alto and Ananta and Maria to Sacramento was a real change in as it turned out in the history of Ananda. We were not the first individuals to move from Ananda Village to urban centers to take responsibility for the centers, but they and we were the first to really spend a great many years in that assignment. Prior to that, if you were assigned, and we did have a small center in Sacramento and one in San Francisco at that time, and a very small one here in Palo Alto, if you were assigned from Ananda Village, which was the only Ananda there was, really, to take responsibility for one of these centers, you considered it somewhere a very temporary assignment, and your main job was to find good devotees and send them to Ananda Village. We just didn't have the same picture of what we were doing. But Swamiji knew with Ananta and Maria, who ended up, they've moved back to the village, but they were 25 years or so in Sacramento. We've been here now, well, you know, 25. And we've created a model in which there's an actual lifetime community established here that individuals can, you know, spend their whole spiritual life living and serving in these settings. And it just didn't exist prior to that. And that's relevant because what was happening right in the fall of 86 was that Swamiji knew that Ananda was about to make a quantum shift. You used to be able to say Ananda, and it meant Ananda Village, because there just simply was no other Ananda. And in fact, among the many things over the course of several years living in Palo Alto, we sort of had to start training people, because people would say Ananda, and then we would say Village, as distinct from Ananda Palo Alto, Ananda Seattle, Ananda Sacramento. There was just no reality in people's minds. I mean, it was natural, because for almost 20 years there was only one Ananda. Why would you say Ananda Village? Because it was just Ananda. But when people's whole spiritual life began to begin and develop in another physical location, and they were as much a part of Ananda as anyone who lived at Ananda Village, then we had to get our vocabulary to catch up with it. But what that meant also is that Swamiji knew that we were moving into an era in which having spiritual centers, churches, temples, that were not, that didn't only serve a residential ashram, but the model that has become quite so common that you might not even think about it. See, these are the things where it's helpful to realize that what you see around you was created by people around you, and it was created with conscious choice for conscious reasons. One of the reasons it's important to understand that is because if those conscious reasons shift for some reason, then it's not as if there's a dyed-in-the-wool necessity to do things a certain way. There's reasons for doing things. There's certainly inspiration behind it. There is, and it has to be said, a tremendous respect for Swami Kriyananda's capacity to attune himself to Master and to act in accordance with Master's wishes. And it's not as if everybody potentially has that same attunement, but that doesn't mean that everybody does have that same attunement. I mean, part of the principle of self-realization is that it is possible to be more or less self-realized. So it's not as if there's no respect for authority. I want to balance that. But authority is not a product of institutional position, organizational position. It's a fact of attunement. I'm touching on lots of other issues. But what I'm saying here is, where I was coming to, is that Swamiji saw that in the founding of Palo Alto, in the development of Palo Alto, in the further development of San Francisco, in the further development of Sacramento, represented by changes in personnel in all three of those areas, he realized that we were really going to start temples, and we were going to become a place where people from many diverse backgrounds would begin to be looking to the Ananda Temple as the conduit and as the source of their primary spiritual inspiration. And their lives could be quite diverse, and their spiritual focus could be spread out over many realities, but they would come constantly to the temple, and the temple would be where they would come to know about Ananda and about Master. And therefore, the Sunday service, which actually I say in the West, but it's not just in the West. I mean, the tradition of going to temples, of going for rituals, of going for holidays, exists in every culture. It certainly is very strong in India, where ritual is enormous. It might not always be Sunday morning, but the regularity of participation in satsang is part of Sanatan Dharma. It's not part of any particular religion. It's a fact of spiritual life, is when we come together for a divine purpose, there's power in doing that. And when we come together for a ritual which has the capacity to reinforce on an ongoing basis certain basic principles, there's enormous power in that. And it's neither Christian nor Hindu nor Buddhist nor Muslim. It's just what it is. It's the way we're made. So Swamiji recognized in 1986 that we'd reached the point where that was needed. We really needed to establish ourselves in such a way that there would be an inherent power in our temples to communicate our teachings. And Master inspired him at that time and in that way, and the Festival of Light was the result. And as I said, he's edited it a little bit. The main part that he edited was the story about the fledgling bird, but in essence, it's the same as it's always been. The music has always been the same. And so we heard about it. We must have heard about it in India. But in any case, by the time we got to Assisi, or maybe he didn't tell us till we arrived in Assisi, because our plan had always been, we went when our tour in India was finished. We traveled to Europe, the four of us, Durga Vidura and David and me, and I traveled to Europe and went to the Assisi community, and Swamiji was just coming out of seclusion, and he had this Festival of Light. And he knew what he had. I mean, he knew in the sense, both he knew the power of it, and he knew the important role that it was going to come to play in Ananda. So it was really quite an event. And we were not at the place that we eventually bought. We as the cosmic Ananda we, when I say that, because I really wasn't part of it, but in spirit I was. The property that we eventually bought, which we called Il Rifugio, because that's what it was called when we bought it, we were at a place they were renting. It was called San Fortunato. And it was a little, I don't know what it was, a monastery or something, but there was a little chapel there. And Swamiji got us all together on one evening, and it was November, so it was kind of chilly and dark. And he got 25 or 30 or 40, wasn't very many, must have been smaller than that actually, because the room was small. And he read the festival for the first time. And he taught people how to play the guitar, you know, the guitar chords for the songs. And he read the whole festival for the first time, and we sang the songs and we listened to it. And, you know, it's a very, naturally, it's an extremely vivid memory in my mind of being in that place and listening to him read it. And there was a quality about Swamiji reading it. I think how to characterize it. I can see it. We were all there, and he was reading it to us, but he wasn't really relating to us in this sense. He was not presenting it to us to see if we liked it. He was presenting it because God had given it to him. I'm going to digress into something so mundane, but sometimes the sublime is illustrated by the mundane. The mundane is the biography of Steve Jobs, which I recently read through. Steve Jobs, of course, is the founder of Apple. I live in Palo Alto, so I have to read the biography of Steve Jobs. I could not. But it was interesting also. But without going into him, which is not the point here, but of course he was responsible for extraordinary innovation in the world of technology and the world of personal devices, as they began to call them, you know, the iPhone, the iPod, all of these things, the iPad. But he didn't do market research. He said, I can't ask people what they want because they don't know what they want until we invent it. And, you know, he was a real visionary. He wasn't trying to meet the mass consciousness where it stood. He was trying to take the whole world of personal technology where it was trying to go. So I use that as an example because it's an accessible one. That was the, I would say Steve Jobs was, had a little piece of what Swami had. I wouldn't say that Swami had what Steve Jobs had. That would be really putting it backwards. But you can, you get the point of what I'm trying to say, which was that Swamiji knew this had come from God. He knew that it was the future of where Ananda was going. He knew that many of us in the room would become light bearers, which light bearers, even the idea of being a light bearer, didn't come until after there was the Festival of Light. We were ministers, but the idea of being a light bearer was something else. He knew that a lot of us would be responsible for carrying this ritual forward, and that this ritual would, to a very large extent, define Ananda, you know, into the generations to come, and would certainly define Ananda for many, many decades, and would place us in a particular reality. So he was just projecting that energy, and here's the right word, we were witnessing it. We were part of it. We were there to witness it. He was offering it to us. But it was had been determined by forces much greater than any of our opinions. As it happened, of course, we loved it. I mean, what was there not to love? It was so just wonderful to have, and this is what we'll go over as we when we actually begin to start going through the festival itself, to have such a beautifully poetic statement that we would be able to, and I have either led in that sense of reading or participated in the Festival of Light nearly every Sunday since that time, you know, since the end of 1986. Because of the positions I've held, I've led it, you know, many, many, many times, and often when I'm not leading it, I'm present anyway. I've heard these words over and over. On a good day, I can recite them all from memory. I keep the book open in front of me because sometimes I have a bad day and I can't remember all the words. And I have to say there's not, well, it, honestly, there's not been one single experience of this when I haven't had some revelation, you know, of greater or lesser magnitude, but a revelation in the sense of a deeper understanding of something that's in there that I didn't really see and understand until that particular moment of reading it. Sometimes when I'm reading the Festival of Light, I mean, it's not a time for a sermon. I just want to stop and say, do you understand the implications of that little phrase there? And that's one of the reasons I'm giving this class, so I can say some of those things. Now, Swamiji, when he brought forward the Festival of Light, he brought it forward first in Assisi, and then he came back to America in time for Christmas, and he introduced it in America, and on Christmas Eve, as I recall, in 1986, he'd also built, the little chapel had been built outside Crystal Hermitage, and he had some of us who he had then designated as light bearers, people who had been ministers. Not everyone who was a minister became a light bearer. A light bearer was someone who was authorized to give the touch of light. So it was a further responsibility, an expectation of sincere willingness to serve as a divine channel. He had, maybe it was just some of the light bearers, but some of us, in the chapel at Crystal Hermitage on Christmas Eve, perhaps late on Christmas Eve. I might have some details wrong, but that's the essence of it. And then we did the Festival of Light together. And when we moved to Palo Alto, which we did on January 4th of 1987, so it was, you know, just a matter of 10 days after that, I actually defined for myself, and I said to others, that my responsibility here is to share to the extent to which I am able the vibrations and the blessing of that Christmas Eve experience of the Festival of Light. Now, many of us, just depending on our samskaras, you know, and our understanding and our willingness to trust Swamiji, our willingness to tune into what he sees, which is often not what's in front of us, not everyone was thrilled by the presence of ritual. Some people associated ritual with dead institutionalism, and were not able to see the difference between what Swamiji had created and dead institutionalism. Some just simply lamented the advent of formality and the disappearance of complete spontaneity. So there was a kind of a reshuffling within Ananda in the worldwide. Every 5 or 6 years over the history of Ananda's 40 years, something happens that redefines the energy. That Ananda has always been going where Master wanted to take it through Swamiji's attunement to Master. And Swamiji has always known really where Ananda was going. But as he told us many years ago, some people became frightened by the vision that he knew was coming rather than inspired by it. So he learned not to talk about it. He just let it unfold. So as a consequence, sometimes people would feel that their idea of what Ananda is was not only the best idea, but was also the God-intended idea. And if circumstances, either directly through Swamiji or other circumstances, contradicted that idea, often there would be a disturbance in the force. And people would have to decide whether or not Ananda, as it was evolving, Ananda, as Swamiji was leading it, was the world they wanted for themselves. And actually, when he named us light bearers, when he put us in formal monastic attire, ministerial attire, prior to that time when you gave a Sunday service, you just wore whatever you happened to want to wear. When he put us in formal robes, and then when he added to the end of Sunday service this repeating liturgy, most people were thrilled, but not everyone. And so Swamiji had to speak a lot about the importance and the necessity of ritual. He said, complicated ritual is not helpful because it engages the mind too much, or else you end up in a situation like what you have in India these days, which is, as one of my Indian friends said to me, it's one of the few, well, he said the only, I'll just take his word for it, the only religion that you have to pay someone else to practice for you. Because the rituals have become so complicated and so specialized with the Sanskrit prayers and the various actions and so on that go with them and the order in which you have to do things, that the average person is simply not capable of carrying them out. You have to be specially trained. It's a profession to be a pujari, to be a priest. It's a job, and it's usually an hereditary job. So your generations of pujaris, and you're trained from a young age how to do all these complicated rituals, and when those rituals are needed to bless a child or remove an obstacle or move into a new house or sanctify a new job or whatever it might be, you hire a pujari, and it's an honorable profession. You hire a pujari, he comes and does whatever the designated ritual is, and you usually have no idea what he's really doing because you don't understand the prayers, you don't understand the Sanskrit. So a ritual like that, there's very little way for the individual to participate in it with a full understanding of what's happening. Even Catholicism until relatively recently, the Mass was in Latin. And it was a huge thing when the Catholic Church changed the Mass into, quote, the vernacular, which was the local language. And the priest turned around. He had it for centuries. The priest had his back to the congregation, and he gave the Mass in Latin. So, and then the priest began to speak the local language, and he gave the Mass facing the congregation. So at least, if you were sitting in there, you had some idea of what was going on. But also, if ritual is too complicated or demands too much of you, as Swamiji explains it, your mind is kept too outward. And either outward in the sense that you're just like trying to tune into a vibe without having a clear idea of what's actually happening, or you're so preoccupied with what do I do now and how do I carry this and where does my thumb go and all these sorts of things that it's all about the externals. And for Dwapara Yuga, which is the age we're going into, we're not advanced enough that we can dispense with form altogether. In my years of Being involved in communities and involved in our temple and sort of helping people be introduced to the spiritual path and become deeper in it. The value of satsang is enormous. You know, the Buddhists talk about sangha. It's the fellowship of other truth seekers. Sometimes the dividing line between people who start out at the same level of enthusiasm and those who stick with the path and those who somehow find themselves drifting away from it is the opportunity to have satsang with other truth seekers. And what kind of satsang are we going to have? Swamiji makes an interesting comment. Even when people come together to meditate, often he said, there is no consciousness of meditating together. But every individual just comes in and has his meditation. And as Swami puts it, doesn't stop to consider that the very thoughts he's having are having a profound effect on the rest of the group. That his sleepiness or his restlessness or his emotional whatever it is affecting everybody's capacity to meditate. Swamiji once commented that when he leads a group meditation, he meditates with and for everyone in the room. So a lot of times, even just coming together to meditate, and you do one prayer, one chant, it doesn't necessarily unify your energy. Often more is required, especially if people live in diverse ways, work in diverse ways, live in various places, and only come together occasionally. More is required to bring all that energy into a unified focus. But when all of our energies can be united, there's a tremendous power in that. And none of us really, I mean, none of us are so advanced that we can just sort of dismiss the importance of that or say, oh, I don't need that, I'll be just fine without it. I mean, at the worst, without that constant opportunity to become reattuned, we lose track of why we're on the spiritual path altogether. My friends, I've seen it so many times. Attunement is very subtle. And that subtle feeling of Master's presence in your life and the longing for that presence and the experience of that presence, when you drift away from it, you don't even remember that you had it. And even more painfully, at first you don't even miss it. And it's only much later when the consequences of having really drifted away begin to manifest in your life. This I've seen too. Just not so long ago, someone came to our temple and said, I read Autobiography of a Yogi 15 years ago. I was active in Ananda for a period of time. And then they used the phrase, then for some reason I drifted away. And then they mentioned just a lot of really difficult things that had happened to them in between, and their life got so hard. And they tried to remember back to a time when they were happy. And he said, when I was reading Autobiography of a Yogi and coming to Ananda, so here I am again. Because the subtlety of that had just drifted away. Well, the importance of being able to come together and not merely sit in the same room, but unite our energies, that's always been the purpose of ritual. As Swamiji says, simple ritual, not too complicated, but deep. And to the central point, you know, drifting down from higher ages, and India is the oldest civilization, and they have all of these things. You know, there's all these different rituals for all these different things. If you need this, if you need that, if you're balancing this, if you're balancing that, you can hire a pujari to do 100,000 of such and so mantra, and that will remove the obstacle, and so on like that. And I'm not going to say that such things are not powerful, because it's a very mysterious and interconnected universe, and many of those rituals came down from higher ages when people were able to perceive and activate those relationships. But the highest purpose to come together is to love God. And to dedicate ourselves and to rededicate ourselves and to clarify our understanding and to clarify our dedication and then to give each other the necessary support to be able to live up to that. Well, that's the Festival of Light. That's exactly what Swami created. He created something that explains in very simple but poetic language. You see, the power of poetic language is that it reaches more, it reaches the feeling level. That's the simple answer. You know, so much of, too much of so-called spirituality can just be intellectual ideas. But the real essence of spiritual understanding also has to come from the feeling level. So putting into the Festival of Light the ritual of music, the ritual in a few places of words that we ourselves repeat, and images that in and of themselves evoke a certain feeling. I mean, holding up a candle to the altar, an arete where we're holding a candle, or there's a line in the Festival of Light that says, "Gaze upon this light as a symbol of God's love." And we light one candle. The temple we have here in this Palo Alto community is a very large temple. It holds, you know, comfortably 300. We can put more than that in there. It's a very large room with a very large ceiling. And I'm usually in the front, but sometimes when I'm in the congregation, I'm toward the back. One candle is vividly seen in that entire room. And I've often really thought about that, especially when I'm standing in the front and holding it. It looks like a tiny flame, but anywhere you are in the temple, not only can you see it, but it has a vivid magnetism that draws you to look right at it. There's another little, just small point, which is the way the ritual goes. There's a tall taper candle, and you light it at the main altar from a candle that's already burning, and then you turn around and walk toward the congregation. Our altar is large, so there's a walk. Some of the temples are smaller, so you don't take many steps, but we have to walk from where we light it to where we stand and hold it in front of the congregation. And the other partner, we usually do the festival in pairs, says, "Gaze upon this light as a symbol of God's love." And often the light is just barely flickering. And when you turn and start walking, and then the words are spoken, "Gaze upon this light as a symbol of God's love." And the whole attention of the whole congregation is on that tiny flame, and invariably that flame grows. And I've so often thought, you know, it's the concentrated power of everyone gazing upon that light, and even that small flame is capable of holding the attention of everyone in that room, because it's a symbol of God's love. Now, I mean, that alone, just think about it. Gaze upon this light as a symbol of God's love. And the, you know, flame is this beautiful orange-yellow color. And it's a living thing. And you know, if you were close to it, it's generating heat. And all of the ideas that we have about fire, I mean, this is a tiny candle flame. But even that tiny candle flame, you could transmute a tremendous amount of seemingly fixed matter just through that tiny little candle flame. You could have reams and reams of paper if you wanted to, and you could just run them right through that candle flame, and they would all turn to ash. So we're gazing upon this light as a symbol of God's love. And what does it symbolize? What does God's love symbolize to us? It symbolizes this extraordinary transforming power. And even the smallness of that candle flame, even the smallness of candle flame, even a small room, nonetheless, a single candle flame is really quite small, seemingly. But even that small candle flame could burn down the whole building, could burn down the whole city, if it were simply given free rein. Now, we think of it in that sense as destructive, but when we think of that same power destroying that which limits us, dissolving our form, dissolving our mistaken idea that we are a limited entity, you see how much power there is in that? Oh yeah, you can just sit there and say, "Oh well, here we go again, gaze upon this light as a symbol of God's love." And if you don't gaze upon the light, and if you don't see it as a symbol of God's love, then nothing happens. But if you do, and if you do that collectively with brothers and sisters who are all equally committed to the same ideals that you are committed to. I mean, this is just one line. You see what tremendous potential there is in that? And you see why, for ages and ages and ages, spiritual people have come together and have often come together in something that was predetermined to enable them to unify their energies, to concentrate their energies, to interiorize their energy, and to raise their energy. So even the name, and now I think I've given you enough of the history. So when we moved to Palo Alto in 1986, 87, you know, right from the beginning, we were introducing the Festival of Light. And in addition to the other elements of the Sunday service, and Swamiji added also at that time the readings from the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita, and that was another standardized element that came in at that point, the affirmations, so that the whole Sunday service had a structure. Whereas prior to that, it had a very loose structure. Now it has a very specific structure. And we can still be inspired and spontaneous, but within more defined parameters. But I'm not going to talk about anything else now except the Festival of Light. The first part of it is, and Swamiji himself describes this, you see, the Festival of Light does not celebrate any specific event. And it does speak of our line of masters, you know, through our line of masters. The great blessing has descended again through our line of masters. So the event it does celebrate is this line of gurus. But what it's really about, from the start to the finish, even just the very name of it, it's celebrating the divine light within us. It's celebrating our capacity to attune to that light. It's celebrating the fact that the masters act through instruments and that the touch of the masters can reach us through individuals that we can have relationships with right now. So the fact of light bearers, which sometimes we're a little too casual, I feel, and we just call ourselves ministers, but we're not ministers. We're not ministering to people. We're bearing light, which is really completely different. You can minister in all sorts of ways, but to bear the light to people, to carry the light to people, to be one who carries the light. Now, I'm not speaking of that from a point of view of organizational position, even though I am a light bearer, and I have been since there was such a thing, you know, formalized within us. But the principle that a light bearer represents is the principle that we all represent. And in a number of places in the Festival of Light, we offer up the little light that is in us into thy greater light, and we ask to be made a channel. We ask to be made an instrument. We ask to be able to share with others, even as we have received. So even though specific individuals become the conveyor of the touch of light, they are also representing everyone in the congregation. Everyone's equal capacity in the congregation, if they dedicate themselves to it, to be a bearer of the light. The formal doing of the ritual is just one way of symbolizing that. But the mere fact that it's done is in itself also part of what makes it so powerful. So the fact that he called it the Festival of Light, what are we celebrating? We're celebrating light. What could be more universal? And even though there is a reference to the history and the truth of Yogananda's lineage and the Ananda line of gurus, as we often speak of it, the masters to whom our temples are dedicated and our lives are dedicated, what we call the ritual itself is the Festival of Light. And a festival also implies, you know, both celebration and expansiveness and a joyous reunion. There's just so many aspects to it. And the one element that we're celebrating is the light. Isn't that wonderful? Can't you just see just from the very beginning how much divine potential is there? Well, that's enough for this session, and starting next week and for the next 3 weeks, next session and for the next three, I'm just going to open the festival at the beginning, and I'll start reading through it, and we'll just go line by line and help bring to more conscious awareness what Master has implanted